Well, good morning and welcome to another Sunday Morning Online here at Nexus. Glad you've joined us this morning. We're going to hop in and pick up right where we left off last week. Of course, we were kind of doing this history of the secular, looking at Charles Taylor and some other authors, sort of talking about the world that we came from and how we've ended up where we are. And I want to jump back into that and talk about our time and place here in history, the age of the secular, you could say. But, you know, I was thinking this week at Nexus here that over the course of the years we've been doing this, I've sat with scores of people who've shared their stories with me of how they ended up here at Nexus. And sometimes it's people who've just passed through our community briefly. Other times it's people who've stuck around for a long time are still with us. But so many people's stories at Nexus have to do with them finding their way here because they entered a season of doubt and deconstruction. And unequivocally, every story that I've heard from these people, it has its genesis, you could say, in an event or some sort of inherited belief that caused some sort of hurt or harm. And whatever that event or belief was, it sort of sent them spiraling into this sea of questions and lingering doubts. And so the formula over time for me seemed kind of simple, right? Hurt and harm in churches equals doubt and deconstruction. And of course, with that formula, the fix seems simple enough to me as well, right? Like if you can just correct bad theology, bad beliefs, and try to create a community with no barriers to belonging, and a community where we do our best to not harm or hurt one another, well, it would maybe take care of the problem. But over the course of many years, right, I've come to see that the solution's not that simple. Because as you will remember from last week, we discovered via Taylor, right, that we live in an age of secularity, and in this age, it's almost impossible not to doubt, to not be in a time of deconstruction. As Taylor says this, we cannot help looking over our shoulder from time to time, looking sideways in a condition of doubt and uncertainty. And so we cannot help but sort of live in this state of doubt. And so it's more complex than just hurt and harm, because the age of secularity itself equals doubt and deconstruction. But when you add in hurt or harm, it becomes like this potent cocktail for people, where the equation almost becomes, right, the age of secularity plus hurt and harm equals exponential doubt and deconstruction. And so to understand our time more fully, the place that we occupy now in history, we've got to get more fully at the nature of this secular world that we live in, what Taylor and others call secular world three. Now, you'll recall from last week that in the first stage of secularism, right, we sort of move into a world where the private and the public are divided. And of course, with the social revolution of the 60s, secularism starts spiraling, and we enter into this time of religion versus a religion. But as the momentum of secularism sort of carries forward and starts steamrolling, we enter into sort of a third wave. And this is where secularism really comes into its own, and we get to the heart of it. And with that, secularism ushers in for us a new ethic and a new authority. Now, according to Charles Taylor, the secular arrives with this new ethic. And the new ethic is this, the ethic of authenticity. And that means no human being should tell another human being what it means for them to be human. It is now, you could say, like an ethical violation, right, to tell another human being how to live. What is most important in our age, this age, is that you lead your own unique life. And this becomes kind of the highest good you can attain to, finding and living into your authentic self. There might be nothing more sort of heretical in our day and age than not being your authentic self. I mean, consider the nature and evolution of bullying over the past, say, 20 to 30 years, and what this tells us about our age, the time and place we live in right now, this age of authenticity. You see, when I went to high school, early 90s, there were certain groupings or labels of people that would probably keep you exempt from bullying, and other groupings that made you subject to being bullied. And again, these labels might look different than your own high school experience, but there's something there for all of us. I mean, in terms of bullying in my time, if you were a jock or attractive, physically intimidating in some way, then of course you'd be fine. And in my days, grunge days, right? If you were the grunge person out in the smoke pit, in the rock band, you know, doing that sort of thing, you'd be fine. And then there were, of course, the preppy people, right? A little Saved by the Bell a throwback there. Preppy people who sort of dressed well, and they were the people who generally ran for student council, that sort of thing. They were generally fine as well. But in my recollection of high school, if you belonged to any sort of faith group, you were probably more exposed to bullying. Definitely if you were LGBTQ, although it was only G back in the day. Of course, computers were in their infancy during that time. And so if you're a person who's interested in coding, or something like that, that was probably a recipe for bullying, although the great poetic justice is those people now rule the world today. That, or if you're some sort of socially awkward, a bit of a loner, maybe you didn't make friends very easily in high school, the academic, whatever it was, those sorts of groupings of people generally were bullied more than others. And the thing is, in high school, at least back in my day, you knew that to be safe, you sort of had to fit in one of those predetermined labels. Am I a jock? Am I a grunge person? Am I a student council person? If you fit into that label, that mold, you'd be fine. But if you ventured outside of that or found yourself outside of that, you were certainly at risk. And so bullying sort of served a function. It sort of made people sort of a homogeneous groupings, right? Like fit into one of these molds or you're in trouble. But consider the nature of bullying today in our high schools. Perhaps there is no more great sin, you could say, in high school than to commit the act of bullying. And thank God for that, right? I mean, it's an absolute fantastic thing that we have so much attention on bullying, because back in my day, I just don't remember anyone caring, right? Like, I don't remember teachers intervening. I certainly don't remember any anti-bullying campaigns or special days devoted to that. But today, the biggest crime you can commit sort of in high school is the act of bullying. It's frowned upon. And why? Because we live in the age of authenticity, and no other human being has the right to tell another human being what it means for them to express themselves as a human. That is a violation of our greatest ethic today. And what has shifted between my high school experience 20 whatever years ago, between my time and our current age, is the secular has taken on its full capacity, you could say. This is what Taylor calls, again, the ethic of authenticity, that no human being should tell another human being what it means for them to be human. And so what is most important today is not that you fit into a label, but that you find your most authentic self. Be unique, be you. And Taylor, of course, this is important to note, he sees this as a very good thing, because what it does is it gives voices to people on the margins, people we normally wouldn't hear from, and it frees us from the yoke of having to find ourselves narrowly defined by labels. But this new excess, he and others say, it also comes with excesses. And you can see this actually played out really funnily in this hyperbolic sort of sketch by SNL that they did a few years ago. It's like, this is sort of maybe what some people think this age is leading to. I think this is funny. Check it out.
My genes tell me I'm a man.
My genes tell me I'm a woman.
They tell me I'm relaxed.
That I'm skinny.
A child.
Yo, you don't know me, genes.
I'm not a style.
I'm not a size.
That's not me.
I am not a child.
I'm me.
I'm unique.
I'm woke.
Woke, woke.
I'm woke.
So, why aren't my genes?
Now they are. Introducing Levi Wokes. Sizeless, style neutral, gender non-conforming denim for a generation that defies labels. Levi's heard that if you're not woke, it's bad. So we made these.
Defining someone by their style? That's offensive.
That's why Levi Wokes have no style.
What's my size?
Why don't you try asking me about my accomplishments?
My Wokes are size me.
They fit everybody.
Because they fit nobody.
So what colors do they come in?
Colors?
I'm triggered.
This color. Can you label this color?
That is the color Greb.
They not brown, but they not brown.
It's a handful of colors, none of which are dominant.
Just like our country.
Oh, wait.
Whoa.
Let's talk pockets.
Pockets sold separately.
Yo, who says I have hands?
You getting this yet? The jeans are woke.
Whoa!
Do they come in men's and women's?
Nah.
Do they come in person?
What do you think?
That's why woke's got Unifly.
180 degrees of gender nonconformity.
My jeans let me decide how I go to the bathroom. Do yours.
What don't you get? They woke.
Woke.
Get woke.
We're woke.
Yo, hold up. Are my wokes made in some factory by Indonesian kids?
Nah, they're made right here in the USA.
By white kids.
It's Levi Wokes.
Woke.
Levi Wokes, available exclusively at Ross.
Oh, I hope you enjoyed that. That really made me laugh because the idea, right, is if you push being unique and not fitting into labels to its sort of nth degree, right, what you maybe get is something like that. Anyway, I hope that made you chuckle a little bit. But of course, as this new ethic arrives, it can move into the comically absurd. It's not just in sketches necessarily, but when this new ethic arrives, it also ushers in, you could say, a new authority that comes with authenticity. And the authority is this: you should really only follow what speaks to you. If something doesn't speak to you today, if it doesn't sort of ignite something within you, well, then, you know, you're free to let that go. I mean, in our age of authenticity, being bored is a great crime and sin, right? That which doesn't speak to me or move my authentic self is something that I can leave behind. And while there are, of course, big potentials and possibilities with this new secular ethic and authority, there are pitfalls as well. And what Taylor reminds us in is if you take this new ethic and authority, and you combine it with the fact that we live in this imminent frame, it creates sort of a problematic progression. Again, a reminder, this is what the imminent frame is. Taylor says this: the imminent frame is a constructed social space that frames our lives entirely within a natural rather than supernatural order. It is the circumscribed space of the modern social imaginary that precludes transcendence. We live in a world, or at least we believe we live in a world that is closed. Nothing gets inside from the outside. And sort of with this, there are five unique challenges. And the first one is this: no outside identity. You see, the secular age, it creates this sort of myth, right, that we're almost blank slates and we get to draw up our own identity, you could say. And what this does, of course, is it means that identity is not something that we receive. It's something that we have to go and find or go and create for ourselves. And you know, as a person of faith, this makes faith formation hard because it sort of sidelines the idea that we could receive our identity from anything outside of us, anything like God. But more than just God, it also sort of sidelines things like family history and tradition. And so as those things get sidelined, the pressure to create our own identity only increases. Our identity isn't something we receive or something that's passed down. It's something we have to find and create. And how do we do that? Well, then our identity is created by our things, you could say. You see, when our identity doesn't come from beyond us, we're left trying to, what Andrew Root calls, find our things. We hang our identity on these things, right? But it leaves us in this quest to find those things that speak to us, that interest us, that we're passionate about, something probably that we can excel in or find rewarding. And the question for us becomes, what are the things I can hang my identity on? I mean, consider parenting today. I mean, parenting today comes with the pressure of trying to find that thing for your child, right? Because if our identity rests on being our most authentic self, and your authentic self needs things to hang its identity on, well, then there's a lot of pressure to find that thing or those things. I mean, contrast that with my own childhood. Let me give you a list of things that my parents exposed me to or programs they put me in when I was growing up as a child. This is the list of things they put me in. Nothing. Nothing. Zero. I was put in no programs, no sports, no arts activities, nothing. Because when I was growing up, it was, hey, you're into hockey? That's cool. Go outside and play with your brothers or friends on the street. Oh, you like playing baseball? Well, go to your park. Organize a game with your friends. There was not so much structure. And, you know, of course, we all knew growing up that person who was into baseball and played baseball or hockey or whatever. But there wasn't as much pressure to bring our children a buffet of options, you could say. And contrast that with the experiences or programs I've put my own kids in by this point in their lives already. I mean, think about a list like this. They've tried guitar lessons, piano lessons, soccer, a forest running club that Kristen put them in. They ran around in the dark in the forest that night trying to navigate, I don't know what it was, horseback riding, parkour, ninja warrior stuff, kickboxing, gymnastics, and hockey. I mean, that is an insane amount of things to expose your children to. And yet, why do we do it? Because, well, we want our kids to be exposed to as many things as possible, because if the self, the authentic self, is the highest good, the new ethic, well, we got to make sure we give them options to try on, things that might fit them. And Andrew Root has this great bit that he does around how when you ask parents how their kids are doing, what it reveals about how that family sees a good life. I mean, consider something like this. Imagine you came to me and said, hey, how's your son Huxley doing? How's he doing these days? I mean, if you asked me that, chances are I wouldn't respond with this. I probably wouldn't say, well, you know, Huxley, he's really working hard at developing his character. And he's been focusing lately on the fruit of the Spirit. And so he's been spending a lot of time in prayer, in contemplation, and he's really come to realize that patience is something he struggles with. And so he's set up for himself. He's reducing his screen time on his own to sort of increase his level of patience. That's sort of how Huxley's doing. That's what he's focusing on. I mean, nobody would say that. No parent would say that. I mean, chances are you caught me on the street and said, how's Huxley doing? It would be more something like, well, you know, we've got him in this learn to skate hockey basic thing. And to be honest, I think we got him in late, so I don't know if this will be really his thing or not, but he seems to be enjoying it. He's working hard at it. He's also doing really well at math. That really seems to be something he excels in, so we're paying attention to how he does in math. And of course, he loves video games, and so, you know, there's some interesting things there. That's the sort of way we would respond. And what Andrew Root says is that this often gives away how we truly see a good life. And so our identity doesn't come from outside, but within. And of course, when that happens, we have to find our thing. But the thing about the age of authenticity is then it moves further, because our identity has to be performed. If you find your authentic self, it has to be performed for others, because you see, what we all crave in life is blessing and affirmation. That's what we want deep within our being, is to be affirmed and blessed for who we are. But when our greatest goal is finding the authentic self, well, how do you get blessing? How do you get affirmation? You have to perform your authentic self. And this is one of the harsh realities about our age. And I believe what's behind so much of our what's going on with our brain chemistry, depression, anxiety, addiction. You see, we cannot live up to our authentic self. And this is what makes living in our day and age so difficult. Like, I love aesthetics and beauty, and I want to be the type of person who's into that and knows a lot about it. But if you look at the books I have on that, I haven't read half of them. If you look at the books around my whole home, most of them are half read or unread. And so there's this constant temptation. I need to be deep and thoughtful thinker. And so I surround myself with books, because that's what someone who's well-read does. And so you have all these reminders, though, around you that you haven't lived up to your authentic self. I haven't kept up with the New Yorker and the Atlantic and all these things I haven't read. And so all around my house are reminders of who my authentic self is, but how I can't live up to it. Or I walk into the next room and I see my exercise bike, and every time I walk by it, I'm reminded that I haven't lived up to my authentic, fit, chiseled pec self. And so it starts to drain on us. And I walk into the next room and I see the piano and I think to myself, my goodness, I still haven't taken music lessons, even though I know my authentic self is a musician. Or every time I log on to my computer, I see my writing, my book sitting there. Why haven't I done anything with it? Brad, if you're authentic self as a writer, what are you doing? You can't live up to it. On and on it goes. And so we live in this sort of pressure zone, you could say, these crosswinds of having to pursue our authentic self, but never being able to live up to it. It's like those dog races where they're chasing the rabbit. The authentic self is always just in the distance, never something that we can actually quite acquire or attain. And what makes it even more problematic is that within the authentic self, there's no mechanism for forgiveness. There's no way to find forgiveness in the age of authenticity, because if it's up to us to define who we are, once we do, when we find that we can't keep up with it, how can you forgive yourself for not being your authentic self? And what part of me does the forgiving? Because in our heads, we're both the defense and prosecution. We're the judge and the jury. And so we live in this pursuit of the authentic self, but there's no grace, there's no mercy or forgiveness. And so we pursue our authentic self, find we can never live up to it or attain it, but have no way to grant ourselves pardon. And so we're stuck, as Taylor says, in this imminent frame. Nothing gets in. And with this imminent frame and also the age of authenticity, we feel stuck in this spiral. It contributes to what has been called the malaise of the modern, right? And I honestly believe this is doing stuff to our brains, wiring us in ways or unwiring us in ways we weren't meant to. I believe it's certainly a contributor to mental health, depression, anxiety, rising rates of addiction, right? All of this stuff plays together because we can't be our authentic selves. And this is ultimately the paralysis we find ourselves in. You know, as Taylor notes, though, even though we live in this age of the authentic with both promise and possibilities, but pitfalls and lingering doubts, even though we live in that, we still have choices to make. And we have choices to make within this imminent frame. And he notes that people can have what he calls either a closed spin or an open take. What does that mean? Well, Charles Taylor offers a single story that he thinks can tell you a whole lot about whether you're a closed spin kind of person or an open take kind of person. And I'll keep it brief, but it's the story of St. Francis of Assisi, right? And St. Francis of Assisi grew up in wealth and privilege, I guess you could say. And then he had an encounter. God spoke to him. And through that encounter, Francis decided to give up everything, live with the poor and the destitute. And Taylor sort of frames this story as sort of a test case, you could say, of how we see the world. Because if you look at that story and say, oh, geez, that's great for him, but you know, I don't really believe in God speaking to people or a voice coming to him. I don't believe in stuff like that. Or maybe you even think of the story like, geez, this is what religion does. It's just so primitive. Then you've got a closed spin, you could say. But if you look at a story or consider a story like Francis's and think to yourself, maybe, you know, I'm not sure what I believe, but I wonder, is there maybe something calling out to me as well? And if that is our posture, that means we have an open take. I think a contemporary example of this might be actually found in the story of Moana. And it's interesting to me how Disney seems to pick up on these bigger themes. But I actually see the story, the film Moana, as a parable for the church. And to me, I think what I see in this film is the imminent frame played out, because as the story unfolds, Moana's a child and she's growing up on this island, and her dad is the leader, of course, and he doesn't want anyone leaving the island. They can go out to the reefs, but that's it. No going past the coral reefs. Everyone stays on the island. Everything is a closed system. But of course, Moana, she's restless. She doesn't know why, but she feels like there's something calling out to her. And then you have her grandmother figure, which to me, the grandmother figure is the church. This should be the church. The rest of the island thinks she's kind of crazy over there on the side, just doing her own thing. But what is her role in Moana's life? It is to constantly remind her and whisper to her that, yes, there is something more. There's something more beyond the island calling to her. And this is the question of Moana. This is the question that was put to Francis. Is there something more calling to you? And I think it's the question that we have to live with and wrestle with in our secular age. Is there something more? And is there maybe, just maybe, something calling out to me? You know, scripture, when you think about it, is really simply a history of divine encounter. Scripture is the story of divine encounter. People encountering God throughout history and running into a moment of transcendence. And of course, you know, the way I see scripture, I think sometimes people got it wrong, what they thought they heard from God, but really it's an ongoing story of people encountering the divine and how it shaped their life. I mean, consider some of the grandest stories of encounter in scripture. You got the story of Abraham, right? Who's just doing his thing, living under his father, living the way everyone else does, but then a voice reaches him, Abraham, go, travel to this land, and it radically shapes his identity. He's no longer living under his father's identity. God has something unique for him. Abraham, go, is story of divine encounter and how that unfolds. Or consider Moses' story, right? When Moses runs into his divine encounter, he's in a full-on crisis mode, which many of us are maybe today around identity. You know, he grows up, he's actually a Hebrew slave, but he grows up in privilege, in royalty, and then there's a whole bunch of conflict. He accidentally kills someone and spends his time, like 30 years, wandering in the desert, tending sheep. And in that sort of malaise of the desert, wrestling with who he is, am I Hebrew slave, am I royalty, what am I in this turmoil? There's an encounter at the burning bush, and it radically shifts his sense of identity. It gives him an identity from outside himself. It gives him a calling and a purpose. Or consider Jesus' encounter with God at his baptism. And it's so important to me that Jesus has done nothing at this point in his life, but he goes into the baptismal waters and a voice is heard from outside of him. It's divine encounter. You've done nothing yet, Jesus, but you're my child. You bring me great joy. Consider Paul. He's living by a certain storyline, right? As Saul persecuting Christians, he's living by the storyline of protecting the boundaries of his people, making sure that they're pure and clean and that there's no watering down of what it means to be a Hebrew, right? And then on his way to Tarsus, he has that divine encounter from the outside and Jesus speaks to him, Paul, Paul, why are you persecuting me? All throughout scripture is the story of divine encounter and how something from the outside, the voice of God, the presence of God, an encounter with God changes people's identity, shapes their calling and who they are. The question is, do we believe that's still possible? I want to leave you with a simple question this morning, and this is a question that every pastor is terrified to ask, but I want to ask it anyway. And it's this question, why are you still here? I mean, particularly for those of you who are watching online, if you've made it this far through my rambling this morning, I mean, why are you still here? Why are you still connected to Nexus? And you know, I'm terrified of what the answers might be. I think there could be a variety of things. People might say, well, I don't know about beliefs, but I love the idea of community, or hey, maybe, you know, Brad's my friend, so I feel I need to tune in every Sunday morning and watch, or whatever the answer might be, and there could be a ton of them, but my hunch is this. My hunch is the reason some of us are still around is because at some point in our history, we had one of those encounters. A moment in life that maybe we couldn't chalk up to complete causation, like clearly God intervened and did this, but also a moment that didn't feel right just chalking up to coincidence. And maybe there's this fuzzy middle where you're like, I don't know if God caused this, but it seems more than coincidence, or whatever that was, an encounter in your life where something happened and today you still can't just let it go. I mean, my hunch is this, the reason that most people, if you're still sticking around at church, the reason you're still here is because there are these moments that you can't quite explain, but they were real to you, they were true to you, and you feel as though if maybe something was calling to you from outside. The alternative, right, is maybe you think about that question and go, that is a good question. Why am I still in? Why am I still tuning in Sunday mornings? Why am I still doing this church thing? And you know, the real possibility is you might have an answer that says, I don't know why I'm sticking around. But my hunch, I guess my hope as well, is that for those of us who are sticking around with faith, it's because we've had one of these encounters. We've had one of these moments and we can't shake it off. We can't let it go. As we close this morning, my encouragement would be simply this. Remain in a place where we're open to the possibility of divine encounter.